Hi, Elise.
Good day, Anand. It's so nice to be a part of your podcast. Thank you for inviting me.
That's my pleasure and great to see you too. So today my guest is Elise Del Rosario. She's currently Chief Finance Officer of her family's One Small Step Forward Foundation. From 2007 to 2009, Elise was the first woman and second Asian president of iForce, and she was also the first Asian and first woman to become iForce Fellow in 2020. Prior to this, she was iForce Vice President at Large and President of the Association of Asia Pacific OR Societies. Elise was an OR analyst at the San Miguel Corporation, and later, with her as its manager, the OR department of SMC garnered the 1992 Operation Research Society of America Prize, or OSAP Prize, for outstanding and ongoing use of OR in organizational decision-making. It was during her SMC years in 1987 that she spearheaded the formation of the OR Society of the Philippines. Upon retirement from SMC as vice president, Elise went into consulting, a major part of which was spent on pro bono work with the Philippine government. An active OR practitioner, she maintains links with academia, keynoting national conferences, as well as publishing papers, acting as referee, and serving in the editorial boards of several international OR journals. Elise, thank you so much for accepting the invitation. As I said in the beginning, it's a great pleasure and honor to have you here. How are you?
Pleasure is mine. I'm fine. And you?
I'm good. So let's start. So you were born in 1955, and Elise is not your original name.
Well, my given name is Elisa. So Elisa del Rosario, that's very Spanish. But since high school, friends call me Elise because Filipinos, you know, they'd like to shorten names. So instead of three syllables, they wanted two syllables. So since then, I have adopted Elise. And I only use Elisa when I fill up legal documents.
Okay. Are you from Manila?
Yes. I stay in Manila. I was born and raised in Manila.
And do you come from a big family?
There's three of us, three children in my family.
Are you the eldest or youngest?
I'm the youngest, and there's really a big gap between my age and that of my brother, is the middle child.
Tell me about your parents' occupation.
Oh, okay. My mother stayed in the house, took care of us, and my father is a businessman who dealt with the production and distribution of paper products.
And what did you do in Manila to have fun during the 1960s and early 1970s?
Okay. Well, I have to search my memory, but as far as I can recall, during summertime, in the afternoons, we would really gather our group of friends, five to six of us, and we would create choreographed dances to the music of Dave Clark Five, Gary and the Playboys, the Beatles, and of course, Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66.
Sergio Mendez.
So we did choreograph, and I guess we're fantasizing that we will appear in a Philippines Got Talent show or something at that time.
Well, that must have been very exciting. Yeah.
Yes. And I also read a lot of books. I like suspense, like Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, and later on Alfred Hitchcock. I like suspense stories, detective stories, yes.
Yeah, did you read Agatha Christie as well?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, okay, Nancy Drew is for youngsters, right?
Yeah, when I was in elementary, in high school, yes.
Yeah.
I would finish all the books in the library.
That's nice. Do you remember having experienced any international influence from the Western world in those days?
Well, as you see, the Philippines was under America, and as well as under Spain. They say that the colonial history of the Philippines can be translated into 300 years in the convent and 50 years in Hollywood with Spain and the U.S. Occupation of the Philippines, respectively. And so we had a lot of experiences with foreigners. But as you can see, a lot of people have been asking me, why are you not speaking Spanish? Why are you speaking English?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
To ask yourself.
Yeah, because you know, when we go to conferences in the Latin America, they speak to me in Spanish, seeing my name, and I say, don't know, un poquito. So I say, I can understand, but I cannot speak, because the Spanish really did not want the masses to learn the language. It was limited to the elite educated classes. In contrast, the Americans, when they came, they introduced their own system of education, and pretty soon English was a major subject for the students. Mm-hmm. So that's how the situation was when I was in elementary school, where basically we are taught, the medium of instruction is English.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I noticed that you speak English with your son at home.
Yes. we speak English with our children. Mm-hmm. They say, how can we say that our first language is Filipino when we dream in English?
That's a good one. Yeah. Wow. It seems that the Philippines were doing all right in the late 60s until Ferdinand Marcos placed the country under martial law in 1972. And please correct me if I'm wrong, okay? and thus becoming a dictator for the next 14 years or so. So how these political changes affect your life?
Mm-hmm. Well, all around us, there was torture, picking up of people. They suspended, prior to the martial law, they suspended the writ of habeas corpus. So they can just pick up anyone. So at that time, I was in high school. I was an activist. I belonged to an activist group. And we were told to burn all our books and the documents that we were keeping, that we were using in our discussion groups. We call them DGs. Because if it is found in our possession, we would be picked up and no one will know where we went or where we are, because no one can demand to see us. So that's what I did. We burned all the books, the documents that we had. So it was really a period of repression, and some of my classmates had to hide and went to the mountains. So that was the kind of repression, and it was not really on the excuse of trying to eliminate communism. It was really trying to eliminate the political opposition.
Okay.
So he really wanted to be a dictator. He really wanted what he wanted to be carried out, and he had a lot of crony capitalists who he gave the businesses of the Philippines to. So it really plunged the Philippines into deep economic trouble. Mm-hmm. So, well, as we said, when he finally left after 14 years of martial law and 21 years of rule, because he was elected for 4 years, and he was re-elected for another 4 years, and then he declared martial law because he did not want to leave the post, because he's supposed to leave after re-election according to the constitution. So he during the martial law days, he revised the constitution, and he was prime minister and president, and And it was really something that's really out of this world. If you will read the history, you will see that he is the, well, I'm not sure whether it's true, but the Guinness tags him as the world's greatest kleptocrat.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read somewhere that, yeah, yeah. Wow.
So it was really not a good stage of the Philippine history. And what really angers us, born in that time and having experienced that period, was that people are supporting his son, who is now running for president. And somehow, during the past several years, the son had gone on a multimedia revision of history. He was posting it on Facebook. He was posting it on several social media accounts of what actually happened, that this martial law never happened. So this is really whitewashing of the history. And that is why we're really supporting the president who is running against him.
Right.
Hopefully she will win.
Yeah. Did your family struggle during that tough period?
Oh yeah. I think all families did for a certain time, for a brief period. There was really a rice shortage, and people don't know where to get the next rice, and you had to line up for rice. And my mother was lining up so that she could get the rice that we had to eat or she had to cook. So that happened.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. You have a degree in industrial engineering, but apparently that was not your first choice.
No, actually, I enrolled for the University of the Philippines. I enrolled for chemical engineering, but then this scholarship came and it required industrial engineering to be your course. And so I said, I tried to find out more about industrial engineering, and I said, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that before. So I said, okay, I'll shift and get the scholarship. And I did.
Wow. And how was your first experience in OR during the undergrad?
We did. What was good about the school is that all our IE major subjects, we had to do project studies where we had to visit a company and then do actual studies in that company and apply what we've learned. And during that time, we went to a chicken dressing plant to determine how best to improve the process using OR methods. So that was a good experience for me.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about the 1970s. Did you have the chance to code any optimization algorithm during your studies? Because you mentioned about yes. Solving real life problems. So yeah. I wonder, how did you do that?
Yeah. We had a regional, we had a computing center and where we had to use punched cards, and we had to submit our what we call JCLs of job control cards, and then get it back the next day. Not the next day, maybe a week after, because of the queue of jobs that had to be done. And we programmed some codes of Simplex in Fortran.
Wow. And how do you learn that? Because there were not enough material, and there was no internet, of course. How did you guys
actually
manage?
There are packages. I mean, there are books that show you the codes for these processes.
Ah.
So we copy and then we just revise when it needs revision.
Okay, nice. So did you go straight to master's after completing your degree?
I believe even now that people should have a job first before going on that for a master's degree, because I did work for 1 year and then I went for a master's degree, and I found that among my classmates who went directly to master's from bachelor's, they had no real feel for how it is in real life when you a job, because the teacher would say, so we will do this, this is a project, so how much time do you think will this take? And then they will say, okay, 1 week. I said, of course not, you can't do that in 1 week. Just because I've had the experience and they didn't. So I think that is very grounding, the experience with a job before you take a master's degree.
Right. You went to Thailand for your master's, right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, primarily because I got the scholarship from the German Academic Exchange Service, which gave me the full scholarship, the tuition, the accommodation, and so on, and a stipend. That was also in high school. We got stipend in high school because I was in a scholar school. Mm-hmm. But then that's what happened. I enrolled in the Asian Institute of Technology, mm-hmm, in Bangkok through a scholarship.
So how was life in Bangkok at the time?
Well, I think that it made me closer to, I had a deeper knowledge of the subjects that I took in college, and it made me closer to OR. It's really at that point when I got closer to OR, and in fact, my thesis was on multi-objective optimization of preferential trade in sugar in the Southeast Asian region. So I learned a lot, and I gathered a lot from various professors who came from all over the world. But having said that, I would be lying if I said I did not enjoy my stay. I definitely enjoyed my stay there because I had a lot of extracurricular activities. I was part of the student union, and I was consistently the chair of the cultural affairs committee, which would organize events where it concerned dealing with the different nationalities, uh-huh, in the graduate school. And it was also very useful for me because it was the first time that I got to interact with people from different cultures, and it was really very enriching, mm-hmm, for me.
Yeah, and that certainly helped you later when you became IFRS president and I mean involved in organizing conference and so on. So this early experience, right, that you had in Bangkok was really important in your career.
Yes, it was indeed.
Yeah. And how was the OR situation in Southeast Asia in those days?
Well, in Southeast Asia, in those days, during my graduate school, at graduate school, we had a lot of classmates from Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, of course, Thailand. But I would say that we were all at par with respect to the education and the knowledge that we had coming into the graduate school. So I would say that we had the same level of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. But were there any societies around or the communities were quite independent and rather small at the time?
At that time, I don't think there were any. You mean OR societies?
Of course, yeah.
There were no OR societies here. Yeah, because I was in graduate school. I 78 to 80, mm-hmm, and as of that time, no Southeast Asian societies had, mm-hmm, been formed. Mm-hmm. But it's a different thing now because we are trying to form a network of Southeast Asian. So far, the IFORS members are only Malaysia, Singapore, and we're trying to pull in Indonesia, Thailand, and we're trying to form a network of Southeast Asian countries, which include Cambodia, Vietnam, Myanmar. Mm-hmm. So it's really growing. So we would like for it to grow.
Mm-hmm. So you came back to Manila and joined San Miguel Corporation soon after the master's.
Oh, yeah. Right. Uh-huh. Well, I would have to tell you that I did not immediately join San Miguel Corporation. Mm. I went into this company, a big holding company, an investment company, and I was doing finance work. And I said, wait, I got my master's degree in, I got my bachelor's in IE, I got my master's in IE. Why am I now doing finance work? So it really occurred to me, and I said, okay, I think I would like to do work along the IE line. And it so happened that a friend of mine, I saw her in the gym, and she said, you know, San Miguel is looking for a senior analyst in the OR department. And I said, oh, I'd be interested. And so that's the story. So I went and got interviewed. And since I had a master's degree, I did work on multi-objective optimization. That is something that they wanted. So I was hired as a senior. I came in as a senior analyst. So that's the story.
Wow. So that encounter at the gym changed your life, basically.
It definitely did. I keep replaying that in my mind.
So what is San Miguel Corporation about? Is it a conglomerate of companies?
Yes, definitely it is a conglomerate. And in 2020, it's accounting for 4% of the Philippine GDP. So that's really a big company. So the company was founded in 1890. So that makes it more than 130 years old. And its sole product was beer. But then it diversified into packaging products like bottles, cartons, plastic crates, crowns for the bottles. And then also because the beer production was producing wet spent grain, which is used in feeds, it went into feeds. So it manufactured feeds. The brewing process also produces CO2, carbon dioxide, which was being used in ice cream manufacturers. So it went into ice cream manufacturer. And since it was going into feeds, then it said, why not go into raising cattle and hogs? So it went into that. And so it also has meat products. Since it had so many properties, why not go into property development? Because it had the land bank of so many properties. So that's how it grew, and it's really such a big company. And one of the advantages of being in such a big company is that you get to learn about all the processes that these businesses are doing, and there are so many areas for optimization in their operations. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we'll discuss later what kinds of applications.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask that for sure. But before I go into the optimization applications, it seems that your first activity was to create a nice spreadsheet for a given sector. There.
I did mention that, you know, when I was new, I was very adept at VisiCalc, which is the forerunner of our spreadsheet Excel. And I was assigned to do the minimization of trim for the corrugated, the manufacturer of cartons, which are used for packaging the beer and so on. So the cartons or the cardboard boxes go through a corrugating machine, and you have to minimize the trim. In that process, 80% of the cost of the finished product is material. So by minimizing trim, you would have an impact on the cost of production. So I was assigned to do that, and I was doing that. While doing that, I realized that the accounting department, who I became friends with because I was practically spending my day there, was doing a manual computation of quotations. When somebody calls and so what's your, how much will this cost? This is a box with this bursting strength and then so on. So you have to identify the inner liner, the outer liner, the corrugating medium and so on. And there was a lot of computations to be done. And I said, okay, the spreadsheet can easily do that. And so I made one for them very, very quickly. And I said, okay, do this. And so it turns out that when a quotation is asked for by a client, then they are able to give the results within the day. Mm-hmm. So it was really a vast improvement just by using a spreadsheet. And I said that, well, this is a really a very good entry because I became very good friends with the people, and it made me it easier for me to do my work, which is the optimization of the minimization of the trim loss for the cartons. So it was really a way of getting into how do you get your clients to turn to you when they need something. Uh-huh. So start with a small job that probably doesn't involve OR, but then since they have experience with you, they believe that you can do the other things that you are promising.
So one thing led to the other, and
And in fact, that project garnered for me a recommendation from the plant manager. Said, okay, this lady is very good, and so on. That was really an experience.
Yeah, fantastic. Sometimes a simple solution like that can pave the way for many opportunities, professional opportunities, and that's nice. Yeah,
for sure.
Well, I'm aware that you work on many practical or applications at SMC. Can you mention some of them, please?
Okay. One thing that I always tell students when they ask me to describe practical applications or actual applications of OR is a mixed problem, because this is what always comes out in our textbooks, the feed mix problem. So you get various ingredients, rice, corn, sorghum, soybean, and of course, wet spent grain, which comes from the beer manufacturer, and put mix them together and to produce the feed. But then, since you had a lot of constraints about nutrient requirements of the animals and the availability of the raw materials, it was really something that you could not do manually, and you had to use LP for that. And what made it more difficult is that we had 50 types of feeds that you had to produce in a batch, and they are all competing for the same raw materials, so you have to give them to the feed that will give you the most benefit, and so you had to minimize the total ingredient cost. So that's one very classical mixed problem. But I guess people don't know about another mixed problem that we had experienced as well, and this is in the production of bottles. They know that the bottle is a mix of soda ash, silica sand, cullets. Cullets are the recycled glass, broken glass that goes into the manufacture of new bottles. So that's another mixed problem that we did. There were a lot of technical considerations. We had to determine the mix so that the softening point and the gob point are just right for that particular product. And the difference with this application is that we are not just minimizing total ingredient cost, but rather we are minimizing the sum of the ingredients cost plus the savings in fuel cost, or the total fuel cost, because the more cullet you use, the greater the savings in fuel costs. Mm. So we were also factoring that in. So that's another mixed problem for you. Mm-hmm. But there's a third mixed problem that I would like to share with you, which is something that we love. Ice cream. You know, ice cream is comes from a base mix. You know, the ice cream flavors that we see, Rocky Road and so on, it comes from a base mix. The Rocky Road you see has chocolate chips, and has some of them might have nuts, fruit flavors, and so on. But they all come from a base mix. And this base mix is a blending of various ingredients, anhydrous milk fat, skim milk, sugar, So and other things. So again, this is a problem of minimizing cost in the an output of the blending process. After the blending, you have homogenization, pasteurization, mm-hmm. aging, and then you add all the nuts and the flavors. So that's two, three very interesting mixed problems mm-hmm. that we did.
Yeah, very nice. Given the nature of the San Miguel Corporation, the nature of the business, I wonder if you had to solve any facilities planning problem?
It's good that you asked that, because facilities planning, which means the determination of where to expand, when to expand, and how to expand facilities like breweries or bottling plants, is the bread and butter of the department. In fact, 40% of the projects that I did as manager for 14 years, 40% of it is on facilities planning, 10% on distribution management.
Wow.
Now, for facilities planning, we plan for the expansion of all the plants, the breweries, the bottling lines. Coke was being bottled by San Miguel in the early years. There was no Coca-Cola bottling plant in the Philippines, but it was San Miguel doing that. So we also plan for expansion of the Coke bottling plants, the crowns of the bottles, the packaging plants, the feed plants, the chicken dressing plants. We all plan for this. And in fact, I have a story to tell, and it's nice to hear about it, especially if you are an OR person, because, you know, in the boardroom, when the divisions present their plans, the president would ask, has OR gone through this? And then I will answer. I said, no, sir. And then the president would say, okay, come back, have OR take a look at it, and see you in the next meeting.
Yeah, talking about so, prestige in the company.
Right. And so, in fact, in your introduction, you mentioned that we got the ORSA Prize, or the right now it's called as the Informs Prize, and San Miguel was only the third recipient of the prize prior to American Airlines and Federal Express. So San Miguel was the third recipient. And during the ceremony where the president was accepting the award, he said that we would not have dared to go into this 5 years multi-million dollar expansion had it not been for the assistance of operations research. So he acknowledged that the value that we put into giving them the proper decisions on how to expand nationwide, the facilities nationwide.
Wow. And how did you feel, seeing the impact of your work put into practice, and also having this recognition, earning of such an important award?
Yeah. It was really very one of the rewards of being in this job. So and the other reward being that when people acknowledge that you have something to contribute to them, and that they acknowledge the help that you have given to them, well, those are the rewards that really give you joy as an OR person.
Yeah, that's a hell of an achievement. Any other applications?
I told you that 40% was facilities planning, 10% was on distribution management. So it was really determining the fleet size. So these are really big 16-wheelers. So how many of those should you maintain? Because at that time, third-party logistics was not yet in vogue. San Miguel was owning all the vehicles that it was operating. And so they were saying that next to the Philippine Army, San Miguel had the biggest fleet of vehicles. But then anyway, we were determining the proper fleet size. We were determining whether to replace or to repair. And then we were also determining sales territories. So to which sales territories will the division of the sales area into territories, and as well as determining there was even a application where we determined the routing of repair vehicles that would service the what do you call this, draft beer faucets or the draft beer equipment. So we scheduled, we did a routing for the scheduling of draft beer technicians who will be maintaining the draft beer equipment. And it was important because it had time windows. You can only go to the restaurant or the pub when it's not operating. Uh-huh. So that was one thing that we did. Well, that's in the area of distribution, but wait, we also determined the fleet size and the composition of tugs and barges. In the southern Philippines, it is mostly small islands, so the beer is being distributed by tugs and barges. So we had to determine the sizes of the tugs and the barges that would ply these routes. Mm-hmm.
And how did you solve all those problems? Using models, heuristics?
Most of the time we were using MILP and then simulation and heuristics, yes. Or a combination of all of them. Mm-hmm. So after getting an optimal, we would do some more heuristics to determine a realistic solution.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that you had a very nice application involving the finance department. Of the company, yeah. Right.
We also had projects in corporate, which you know, the corporate deals with 14 large banks, and they
14
get
banks.
Loans. 14. 14. Wow. And they get loans because, you know, it's such a big company, so they get loans from these banks. And then one thing is that if you give collateral business to the banks, they will give you a decrease in your interest, in the interest that you have to pay on your loans. So what is collateral business? Collateral business means that you course to the bank your tax payments, your letter of credit, payment for imports, and then a payment for exports. So you let it pass, let this money pass through the bank. And when you do that, the bank has a 7-day window in which they could use the money. And so they would like your collateral business. And so the problem then was, how do you then distribute the collateral business to the various banks so that you get the lowest interest that you have to pay, the lowest interest? So that was another MILP problem that we solved.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, as you've been discussing, the San Miguel Corporation is an important company in the Philippines, and it's related to all sorts of business. And you mentioned the beginning about meat production and things like that. So I wonder if there were any applications involving different creatures.
Well, for one thing, I was really involved in the production of shrimp in San Miguel, was in aquaculture, so I knew a lot about the spawning. And then, but then anyway, an interesting application that we did was, San Miguel was very interested in determining how to lower the cost of of the pork that it was using to sell. It sells meat, it sells cut-ups, it sells processed meats. And so it was really wanted to determine how to lower the cost of the production of this pork. And so they researched and said, and found a breed that had a very good FCR, or feed conversion ratio, which means that how much feed do you need in order to get a 1 kilo gain in weight. And they had this breed that was very efficient in that. And then they asked, how do we make our current breed be this breed? So it involved an importation of the sows and the boars to mix with the current breed until the time when they have achieved the desired feed conversion rate, or when they have achieved the maximum gross gross margin. So that is really the objective. And we were able to use MILP with some Markov chains to determine the you know, when you have the new herd and you have subject to probabilities of whether they will be fertilized, they will fertilize the existing, and when the existing is fertilized, how many children, how many piglets do you produce. So that is really a very interesting application, and it also determined whether we will put up an artificial insemination facility, because that would be more efficient rather than just relying on natural breeding. And the result was that we had to put an artificial insemination facility, and we were able to achieve the steady state of the breed at a certain time.
That's a fascinating application.
Yes.
I wonder if you have any other applications involving different animals.
What other animals do we have? Well, I told you the shrimp. So we had
chicken.
Oh, chicken, yes, the chicken. San Miguel is very well known for its chicken. And, you know, the chicken has to go out to the market at about 1 kilo, because that's what the market wants. It cannot be heavier than that, otherwise it will not be sellable. So people are more thrifty, they want the smaller ones. So the problem now is how to determine the reproduction line. I mean, when do you hatch the chicks? And then at which day do you transfer them to the growers? And then when do you harvest them from the growers? And using this pipeline, you now determine, you forecast the harvest at each at that particular point, and then you forecast that, and then you feed that to the dressing plants, who now know how much of the chicken is coming in for them to be dressed.
Wow. What an unusual application of our yeah. What about marketing? Did you tackle also that area?
I can really think about one that really stuck, because it was really very impactful. At the time when we were in the OR department, when we were doing all these projects, we were, TV shows are very popular. There were so many channels, and then there were so many shows. And if you have a brand manager who's in charge, let's say, of juice for children, who chocolate, let's say, it's a chocolate drink in Tetra Bricks. So we would like to know, in what shows would you put this advertising to reach the maximum target market? And of course, you wouldn't put it in sports shows, because your target are children and the mothers who buy the juice. Well, for beer, maybe you will put it in shows that that feature boxing or basketball games. So you have to keep in mind the target audience for this particular application, and then you have to determine how many 30-second ads you will put into that show, and you have a cost for each of these placements. So what happened was that before we came in, the advertising managers just rely on the recommendation of the advertising agency. Oh, you put it here, so here, this is what you do. And then the advertising manager would, the brand manager would say, I don't like this show, so you you change it with another show. But then I told them that we can do this. There's a more scientific way of doing this. We consider the target audience rating points of the various shows, the cost it entailed, and what and so in the end, we were saving so much per business unit. We were saving about $2 million per year per business unit, where when we applied this particular application. So we had two functions. You could maximize the target audience rating point subject to the constraints, or you could maximize the target audience rating points subject to constraints, and you could also minimize the budget that you require, provided that a certain target is so your constraint now is the TARP. So the right. TARP is you have to reach this TARP, and how much budget was the minimum budget that you can share. So we came up with a lot of shows. We allocated the advertising to the various shows for each of the products.
So you're sitting at home watching TV and say, hey, I put that advertisement in that show.
Yeah,
that's awesome. You were also involved in a joint venture with China, right?
In fact, yes. San Miguel at the time was looking into the opening. A strategic step was to look into the opening of China to the external world. And immediately TAP management said, we are going into that market because they also have a lot of breweries and they consume a lot of beer. But China then, of course, does not allow businesses to set up. So they only allow joint ventures. So we entered into a lot joint ventures, so all over China. But there came a point, I think about 5 years later, when they realized that we are not getting the returns that we wanted or we expected. And so there was a decision of rationalizing these facilities, which ones should be closed, which one should be expanded, which one should we get out of, and which area should we not serve. So this is very challenging for us because modeling wise we were so used to facilities planning problem, but this particular case was really different. Instead of minimizing costs in the Philippines where we always satisfy demand, here we are maximizing profit because we don't have to satisfy demand. And so there are a lot of characteristics of the business of doing business in China like having to go with a joint venture and having to make sure that the royalties for the beer that they are producing go to them and the royalties for our beer goes to us. So there were so many considerations that we had to input into the model. So it was very challenging in terms of the modeling aspect, but the most rewarding portion was when we were running these models daily. We would meet with top management who would consult us on, which are we closing? And there was sometimes it gets very emotional because some managers really feel that this should be kept open. Then we just reason with them, said, no, but if you keep opening that, you will incur a lot of loss in profits. And so, we had a discussion and to the point where management was kept asking us, okay, at which of the plants, in which plants should we have more ownership and how much should we pay for that? In which plants should we give up ownership and how much should we sell that share? So these were the questions that were being answered by our model. Mm-hmm. And I was really very glad that they found use, and I really sincerely saw that they were very useful for top management decision making.
Yeah, great. Now tell me about your involvement in the creation of the OR Society of the Philippines.
Okay. In fact, I went into the, I was active in promoting the Operations Research Society, or not promoting, but forming the Operations Research Society of the Philippines, mainly because it was really hard to get qualified people to man the OR department. The OR department then had an average of 15 people working on 25 projects. So it was really hard to always get people to, qualified people mm-hmm. to be recruited into the department. And so I said that maybe if we band together all operations research practitioners, we could really have a network from which we can source, and we could also help each other in terms of getting more knowledge or getting more experience from others. So that was the main motivation for the formation of the ORSP, which I did very soon after I was made manager of the department. So along with other people who had contacts with other companies, we formed. So I co-founded it, and my co-founder was my boss in my first job, in my very first job. So we co-founded it, and it flourished. It's very, it's going on very well till now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very important achievement, you know, to put things forward, not only in the company that you worked, but also the community in general. You wanted to hire people, you wanted to create that culture of having more OR people around. So that is definitely a remarkable contribution. So after your retirement from SMC, you acted as consultant both private and pro bono.
Oh yeah, I did work for private companies, mostly in supply chain. But what I found more rewarding was the pro bono work with the government, because it was really an entirely new experience for me. Because when you work with the government, one time I went to the office and said, "We need the data on this," and they said, "Oh yeah, it's there." And he pointed to me a filing cabinet. So I had to go through the folders to look for the data, rather than just, well, I was so used to the fact that in San Miguel we would just have the data already in the computer. We will just have to download it. So it was really very different, and there was a lot of politics. There was a lot of determining whether your recommendation will be implemented or not. And so I learned a lot from the work with the government. I also had some advocacy, because at that time there was the president was trying to push the operation of the Philippine ports to a monopoly, to one crony. And then we had to prove that it will make sense to divide it into two, so that there will be more competition. And we did this through OR methods. We simulated the arrivals of the ship, whether they could be accommodated, and whether two operators can do it. And we said that the IRR can be achieved, the desired IRR can be achieved when you have two operators. So that was another application that we did.
Right. What about I-Force? How was the entire experience, including being the first woman to become president?
Well, it was really very enriching for me personally, because I really got to meet a lot of very nice people, and people you can turn to when you have a question, or when you need something done, or when you want to help. So it's really a huge network of very qualified and very good people. So it was really very satisfying, because I felt that I did my part in something that I am always very I felt very strongly about, which is the promotion of OR in all over the world. So I did promotion of OR in the Philippines, but I had a chance to do it all over the world by being the IFORS president, by carrying out the activities that had been done before and embarking on new ones.
Mm-hmm. You created the IFORS news that is still going on to this day.
Right. I was very, very emphatic that we need to open communication lines between between the members and other people, the OR community in general, even if they are not members. So I felt very strongly about the newsletter and the website, which I took charge of when I was already immediate past president. But then I directed that it be done when I was president.
Right. You also organized several ICORD conferences, correct?
Yes, because I was my first assignment with IFORS was as Developing Countries Committee Chair. And as such, we were in charge of the International Conference on OR for Development, or ICORD. So it was held in various countries. One of them was in Manila. Two of them, I think, were in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Some in India, Africa. So we organized those conferences. And after that, lately, we organized workshops on OR for Development, both for IFORS and for Europe.
Right. So throughout your entire career, have you experienced any situation in which you were underestimated for being someone from a developing country?
Not really someone from a developing, or maybe yes, or maybe it's because of the color of my skin. You know, we were doing a facilities planning for our Hong Kong brewery, and we went to Hong Kong, and guess what? We had to bring with us a white consultant who had to present the results. But we were all doing everything. We're gathering the data, we're running the model, we formulated the model. But someone, a foreigner, a white person, had to present the results so that it is more credible. So that's one experience that I still remember till now.
Wow. How did you feel?
Well, it was more of acceptance. So that's how things are. But the consultant knew and I knew that we did the work. So that was what was important.
Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about your foundation, One Small Step Forward. What is it about?
Small Step Forward Foundation came out of when my husband and I had retired, and he was constantly disappointed with the low rankings of the Philippines in the international test that are being given to grade school children. And it really has to do with the decreasing level of standards in public school education in the Philippines. Would you believe that in some cases, children go home with books, but they had to share? Two children have to share one book. So how can you study with that in that kind of a situation? So there's really a lowering of standards in teaching, and there's really maybe a lack of funds, and not enough schools are being built. So teachers are forced to promote students to the next level, even if they're not, they have not technically passed. But these are for the public schools. For the private schools, it's a very different story, because the private schools are miles apart from the products of the public schools. And so my husband said, we have to do something about the education, because it's really very important. It's what gives them hope for the future. It's what gives them the things that they can look forward to. So our children grew up doing the Kumon method. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with
that. Yeah, it's all over the world.
Yeah. So we established something like that. At first, we were cooperating with Kumon to give us lower rates, because as you know, it's really expensive, mm-hmm. to give us lower rates for us to be able to give it to the students in the private public schools after school. No, so these are classes done after school. But then at a certain point, I think they had limited budget as well. And so they stopped the program. And so what we did was we developed our own worksheets, which the children could work on. And we have the worksheets from grade school to high school. And so far, 2,000 students have undergone the training. And good results include that the schools that we were in sometimes, the good news is that they compete in math competition. So it was really nice for us. And we also get letters from parents when their children have graduated. And then my husband keeps meeting people who said, "Sir, I'm already a data scientist. Remember me? I did your program." And so these are very fulfilling mm-hmm, yeah. Experiences when you know you have helped and somehow brought students to their full potential. This is specifically only in math.
Yeah, that's a great initiative, and it's very nice to know that you're getting nice results and you're getting this nice feedback from former students that took part of the program. Well, Elise, you have occupied several roles in your life. You were an activist. Then you became part of students' union, or analyst, and all the way to vice president of a big conglomerate, which is San Miguel Corporation. I first president. You organized several conferences. Now you have this family foundation going on. And I think in some of these situations, you are probably one of the few women around or in the room or in the meetings or in part of the group. How did you address these situations? Were there any issues? Tell me about this experience.
Uh-huh. Well, I have never looked. Somebody had asked me before, but my response was I had never looked at myself as a woman, but as a person if we are in a meeting room and we're trying to do something, as a person who's trying to achieve this objective. So I go past that, and I just see cooperative work going on among all the participants, and that has never really bothered me, and that has never really entered my mind that, oh, I'm a woman, and so they don't treat me well. So that has never entered my mind.
Never held you back, right?
Yes.
So, but do you have any message to the young women that are listening to this podcast?
Yeah. So do the best in whatever is worth doing is worth doing well, and always do your best. That's my motto. If I don't think that I could put in my best effort into that, I don't do it. So always try to do your best. And if you fail, keep trying. Somehow you will get it.
Yeah, nice message. Elise, in my opinion, you don't look like someone of your age. How do you keep yourself fit and healthy?
Well, pre-pandemic, we were attending fitness first classes in the gym, and I would go around doing spinning. I will do lifting weights and the high intensity interval training, Zumba, yoga, and I have done all the classes that they offer in in Fitness First, and I have a regular program. So MWF, I do at least two classes. So, but then during the pandemic, of course, there was no gym. So what happened was my husband and I, we just walked within our gated community about 5 kilometers every day. But that's not really running, or but it's just normal walking. And when we get home, we do cardio exercises. Well, I do bar, Pilates. So those are the things, and yoga as well. So I try to keep fit because, you know, they say that when you're young, you take care of your body. So when you grow older, you know, your body takes care of you.
Yeah. And what are your plans for the future?
Well, I would like to spend more time on the R Foundation. To people had been telling me to quantify the results of the things that we had been doing. So in terms of the scores that they get, so I have not really gotten around to thinking about it. But I think I will use my OR to quantify effects of the foundation work that we are doing. And we pursue more activities along this line and see how we can offer more opportunities for the students in the public schools.
Do you intend to continue to promote OR in Southeast Asia?
Of course, of course. That is really something that I am passionate about. The University of Kent has put up a program, the Southeast Asian Network, which involves societies that I had been targeting for the longest time in Southeast Asia, Thailand, Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, Myanmar. So we have not been able to get through them. As IFORS president, I kept going to Indonesia and to tell them to create their society. But now there is this opportunity through the help of the University of Kent, and I think it's going along well, and I am helping them with it.
Excellent. Well, Elise, it was fantastic to talk to you. I want to congratulate for all your extensive work, not only the STOR work, but also the foundation and acting as a promoter of OR all over the place. That is fantastic. And it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for giving me the chance to say all this.
Yeah, it has been very, very inspiring. Yeah, I just loved all to hear all these applications that you study and solved it, and the recognition you got from the Western world, if you will, right? The Orso Prize, and then all the other things that you did with a lot of impact and changing the lives of many people. That is just fantastic. So once again, it has been wonderful to talk to you, Elise, and I wish you all the best. And I even hope to meet you in person one of these days.
For sure.
Okay, so see you soon.
Same here. Right. Same here, Anand.
Thanks. So, ciao. Bye, Elise.
Bye. Bye.